special edition of House of Comments. My name is Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Margaret Heffernan, who is the author of Uncharted, How to Map the Future Together. So Margaret, please tell me, what was the inspiration for this book? How did it all start for you?
What really brought me to this subject was in the course of the Brexit referendum and the Trump election, people kept asking me what I thought was going to happen. And I kept thinking, why on earth are they asking me? Why should I know? Nobody knows, because, you know, people are changing their minds daily. And it just struck me that people seemed to think of the future as something that was sort of behind a curtain, like in The Wizard of Oz. You know, and if you were lucky, you could peek beyond it and see what was going on in there. And they found it really difficult to get their heads around the idea that actually the future hasn't happened yet, and therefore it is intrinsically unknowable. And I started thinking about the ways in which people think about the future that get them into confusion or allows them to make mistakes. And that included things like thinking that history repeats itself, which it really doesn't. You know, that people have have particular kind of psychological profiles that determine how they will act in every situation, which they don't. And I just became very fascinated by these kind of cognitive thinking mistakes in thinking about the future, and wanted to understand better how they worked, and more than that, wanted to think about whether there were better ways with which to engage in what is fundamentally unknown.
So I think, there is a, you know, the famous phrase, fear of the unknown. And in the first sort of third of the book, you look at the many ways in which people have tried to first develop models for knowing the future, but also capitalizing very much on those models and on our fear of not knowing.
Right.
So would you say that getting over that fear is the first step?
I think that's absolutely fundamental. I think because we don't know the future but are afraid of it, as you say, that leaves us susceptible to all kinds of people who want to sell us their view of the future. You know, so every year, almost like clockwork, we get this story coming out of Silicon Valley that this is going to be the year of virtual reality. You know, it was in the papers even again last week, you know, that because we can't go on holiday, virtual reality is finally going to come into its own by giving us virtual vacations. We are endlessly subjected to the propaganda around driverless cars, which are always just about around the corner, even though the more research that goes into them, the harder the problem turns out to be. And we fall for this stuff because essentially people are selling us technology. They're trying to sell us their expertise. They're trying to dominate a market by co-opting our future rather than giving us reliable information with which we might conceivably be able to imagine it together. So we work in this kind of ocean of propaganda and marketing, which presents itself as forecasting, presents itself as futurology or future-proofing. And actually, you know, what we have to remember is that every forecast has an agenda. Mm-hmm. And the secret is kind of in the word. You know, casting forward means trying to shape something. It isn't about seeing what's there, because there isn't anything there yet. So I think in order to free ourselves of the shackles of forecasters and propagandists and marketeers, we have to start to get much more comfortable with how much about the future we really don't know.
And in terms of making sure that, you know, that we find a balance between not just going into everything completely blindly,
right,
but also being aware that we people who tell us exactly what's going to happen have an agenda, as you say,
right,
but also B, that, you know, there are numerous scenarios,
correct,
that we may be able to push ourselves towards one or another of those scenarios if we do the work beforehand. Would that?
Yeah, I think that's true. So I think there are a couple of kind of there are some tent poles here, you know, so we're not just kind of just standing without any kind of structures for our thinking. And I think the first of these is understanding that, you know, why can't we see the future? We can't see the future because much in our lives is highly complex, and it's in the nature of complexity that while there are patterns, they won't repeat themselves endlessly, which means also that expertise is valuable, but it's rarely adequate because it's very difficult to keep up expertise up to date as fast as things change, which, of course, we've seen absolutely in the course of this pandemic. So we have to start to think about, so what are the things in our lives that are inherently complex, which therefore really can't be predicted, versus much simpler things, which I think of as complicated, so that we can predict them just because they're the same every time. You know, so we mostly are safe in predicting, you know, that if I turn the doorknob, the door is going to open. We're safe in predicting when we check our baggage at an airport, the bag is very likely to arrive because this is a very repetitive process. We have to sort of understand that the more repetitive the process, the more reliably we can forecast it. But when it comes to things which are complex, which are new, which are untried and untested, and which have many, many, many different factors influencing them, then we're likely to be in a complex environment, and we can't be entirely sure in any situation how it's going to play out. And in those environments, and this is characteristic of the environments in which most people work, for example, and plan their lives and their careers, really the way we figure out what's going on and where should we go and how can we make decisions is by making experiments. So we do this in our own lives, for example. You leave university, you are absolutely convinced that what you really want to do is to work in PR. You get a job, you work in PR for a year or two, and you suddenly realize, actually, it isn't at all what you thought it was. It really doesn't suit you. And you do what my niece did, which is you leave PR and you train as a family lawyer. The training as a family lawyer, that's an experiment too. In her case, it was more successful. That doesn't mean it's what she's going to want to do throughout her life, because she's going to change and the legal environment is going to change. So a great deal of how we determine our personal futures are by doing experiments, you know, dating before we choose a life partner, to figure out where am I vis-a-vis the world and what is it that really works for me right now. And one of my arguments is in the book is that in our organizations, I would say both in businesses and indeed in government, we ought to be much more open to experiments, because that it's in doing experiments that you really open up the possibilities that the future might have to offer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting was the definition quite near the beginning of the book, difference between a system that is complicated and a system that is complex.
Right.
And the world is complex, right. But in order to try and simplify it, we try to impose complicated systems onto it that don't actually see the whole picture.
Right.
And that is obviously a huge temptation, particularly, I mean, I've worked in and around Whitehall, Westminster for years, and you see that. And I think particularly at the moment with the craze for data-driven policymaking, that is a huge temptation to try to impose order where order there is none.
Right. Well, I think that, but also thinking that what worked before will work all the time, every time.
Yeah.
And what that does is it fails to take into account that the context has changed, that, a way of communicating with people that used to work may not work anymore because our means of communication have changed, that the sort of language we use in politics may not work anymore because it seems too remote. It seemed too paternalistic. It may seem too distant. So there's society is so intrinsically multifactorial that you can't keep tabs on it all the time. But what you can be pretty confident of is that the things that worked before are likely to be in the process of change. And therefore, we have to keep really alert to how they're changing, where they're changing, and so on. And I think you often see many politicians coming unstuck, thinking that ideas that seemed absolutely brilliant 20, 30 years ago land with a bit of a thud these days. And that a lot of the values that people, especially that political parties, take for granted, that they change in quite subtle, not terribly obvious ways. And the adherence of those principles change too.
Yes, it's one of my constant frustrations in politics has been watching people, the generals always fighting the last war.
That's right.
What struck me when I was reading the book and you're right about, there are always lessons to be learned from history, but we tend to derive the wrong lessons because we try to believe that it's repeating itself.
Yes, and I think, you see this particularly in the way that politicians in particular tend to use analogies with history, and the kind of poster child for this is always Munich, that Vietnam was Munich standing up, to a dictator. Korea, the Korean War was Munich. Saddam Hussein, brought forth, the ghost of standing up to a terrible dictator. And the problem with these sort of analogies is that they tend to emphasize the similarities between the two situations and completely marginalize and trivialize the differences. Vietnam really was not Germany in the 1930s, but thinking that it was led to catastrophic policy and military decision-making on the part of America, of the American government. Thinking that Saddam Hussein was Hitler and that Iraq was Germany in the 1930s, has led to a catastrophic war, which seems to have no end because it's a completely different kind of event. So it isn't that history is useless. It absolutely is not useless, but we would do better to see where these analogies break down, where the salient differences reveal things we might not otherwise see, instead of really falling prey to the kind of aesthetic nicety of analogies that make us feel, well, of course, we're going to win.
There's an old phrase that I've tried to invoke quite often, which is that you never stand in the same river twice.
That's right.
And the river banks may look the same, but the water is completely different.
Yeah. And also you are different.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Too. The feet in that water are different. So you have change on every level. And it's kind of interesting, I think, at the moment. It's obviously Boris Johnson is well known for his self-identification with Churchill. But it's really striking, that he identifies with a very slender slice of Churchill.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
With his whole life, not with the degree to which many people in the country hated him before the war and hated him after the war. He seems not to remember that face of Hitler. He seems not to remember British war crimes. He just seems to remember this extremely simplified notion, what the fantastic historian Michael Howard calls nursery history.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's very primary colours government. Yeah, absolutely.
So yet it's kind of using history as a form of propaganda to persuade you that you're in the same place in the river, but of course you aren't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the, so when in the second part of the book, you start examining, in my head, because I come from partly, as you say, we all try on many, many hats throughout our lives. One of the things that I do at the moment is I'm working with a fantastic organisation that look at how to do change, change making through the voluntary sector. And civic society, which is obviously going to be very challenged in the next few years after what's been happening at the moment. And we have had, you know, for a long time, the kind of the model has been theory of change. Right. But you see that as the wrong way round of looking at change. Is that right?
Well, I guess, I mean, I've worked with a lot of organizations that, as far as I can see, have spent years looking for a theory of change. And I've always been rather puzzled as to why they do this. And I think I've concluded that they want a theory of change to prove that what they're doing is right so that their funders will continue to fund them. Mm. So they choose the theory of change that suits them best, which is, you know, completely the wrong way around, really. And I was very interested recently after the many kind of big public protests, Extinction Rebellion did a kind of retreat to consider a theory of change. And I think ended up choosing three, which seems to me, you know, almost as useful as choosing none. I think if there were an absolutely compelling bulletproof theory of change, we'd all have figured it out by now. Mm. And I think the thing about change is it pretty much repels theory. If you think of theory as being something that, you know, produces reliable outcomes, you know, like the theory of gravity, you know, you can pretty much rely on the fact that if I pick up my cup and let go of it, it will fall. We don't have anything nearly as robust as that when it comes to theories of change. And so I think instead of trying to figure out a one-size-fits-all kind of model for action, we do better to do experiments. Because the thing is that you can try something today that doesn't work and later on try it again and it will work. And the difference is the context has shifted. And, you know, I write at some length in my book because I think it's such a beautiful example of the incredible work done by Rebecca Hosking, who was a camera person in the BBC's Natural History Unit, who made a very brave, heartfelt, well-researched, absolutely rock-solid, brilliant film about how plastic was ruining the oceans in 2005. And, you know, she had traveled so much with the Natural History Unit making films. She had seen this and was appalled by the degree to which nobody was telling that story. So she made this film thinking, this will wake people up. And it went out one night. She woke up the next morning. Absolutely nothing had changed. Mm. Nobody cared. Nobody paid attention. She was heartbroken. But she didn't give up. And what she did was she sort of retreated wounded to her little village in Devon and thought, well, if I can't change the world, let me see if I can just change my village. And she persuaded the entire village to go plastic bag free. And thinking this is just a small experiment, but at least, you know, I might be able to do something. And she did that, and she woke up the next day, and the world's media was on her doorstep. China that month banned single-use plastic bags, you know, with a single decision. Rebecca Hosking did change the world with an experiment, but it wasn't the first experiment. Mm. So I think, you know, what it shows is that, you know, it's like we're in a kind of, like we're in a room and we know there's a door somewhere. We just don't know which part of the wall it is that will spring open and let us out. And so we have to keep kind of poking around thinking, well, what works today? And maybe that brilliant idea that everybody rejected 3 years ago, maybe I should bring it out and try it again. Mm. Because there's so much change in the system that a single failure may not mean anything except that the timing was wrong.
And how does that fit with the other sort of part of your analysis, which is the long-term designing beyond yourself, the cathedral thinking, as you call it?
Yeah. So cathedral projects, I think, are really interesting because these are projects which are designed to last longer than a lifetime. And they're distinct from mega projects, you know, which have a deadline. Mm. So cathedral projects are founded on what I think of as a guiding principle. CERN, I think of as a modern day cathedral project, which is dedicated to the peaceful discovery of and use of physics. So that is its guiding principle in the same way that glorifying God is the guiding principle of Gothic cathedrals. Now, the great thing about this guiding principle is it has real passion and faith in it, but it doesn't have rules in it. And so if you look at CERN and how it's managed to make planned discoveries, but also many unplanned discoveries, you see that it's managed to do that by cleaving to that general principle. But in each era and under each different director general, finding different means of doing it. So it's highly defined in terms of what it's for, and very, very, very loosely defined in terms of how it pursues that end goal. And I think of this as being kind of tight and loose. Tight in the aim, loose in the means. And what that means is that the organization can and does change over time, all the time. It's always asking hard questions of itself. What is the best use of our resources right now? Should we be doing this or should we be doing that? It has a very, very loose and fluid structure in terms of scientists coming in and out, in terms of many of the world's leading organizations collaborating with it. And it has developed a fantastic kind of ecosystem and mindset for working with other major institutions all over the world. So it has a kind of organic flexibility that most commercial organizations, I would say, lack. And what's really interesting is many commercial organizations work with CERN and they come away saying how much they've learned, not about physics, but about this particular way of working. So I think cathedral projects endure because they're absolutely determined in terms of what they're for, but they're very, very loose and adaptable and responsive to new ways of articulating that purpose.
And it's really interesting. I was thinking about government as a cathedral project.
Well, yeah, so I think democracy is definitely a cathedral project. And I think, you know, in the UK, we've probably made a mistake of thinking that it isn't a cathedral project. It's just a cathedral, right?
Yeah.
It's just there to be preserved unchanged.
Yeah.
And I think this has been a terrible mistake because actually we've made very few changes to our democracy really since the Second World War. And so I've been very fascinated by the experiments in deliberative democracy, largely scoped out by James Fishkin, who's done, I think, 109 of these in 28 countries, and who keeps discovering when you bring groups of ordinary citizens together and you give them well-researched, reliable information, good moderation so that all voices can be heard, and let them really work through the issues, two things happen. One is everybody changes their mind because they're paying more attention because they know their deliberation really matters, which people generally don't do in politics right now because they know that one vote isn't going to make a difference. In small groups, people really pay attention. And they tend to make very, very good recommendations, which when implemented, tend to work out really well. And they tend to work out really well, I think, for several reasons. One is they're not ideological. They're the decisions are made or the recommendations are made by people who know they have to live with them, which changes the way they think of it. They know that what they recommend has real consequences immediately for them and their friends and their family and their community. And the consequence of that is that these recommendations have real legitimacy. That unlike party politics, where people increasingly think, well, this is just self-interest for the party or the individuals in the party, these deliberative democratic recommendations are seen as being legitimate because they're made by the people who are going to live with them and implement them. And I think increasingly what we are going to see is that legitimacy is the real holy grail of democratic governments. It's something that they feel or know that they lack currently. that most of them haven't been elected by the majority of the electorate, that their policies haven't been specifically endorsed by the population as a whole. And so I think this question of legitimacy, both in government and in any kind of organization, is increasingly going to dominate both the political and the management agenda.
I was fascinated by, so there's the unhappiness in Slovenia, despite all of the traditional markers being on the uptake.
Yes.
And they and they responded what seemingly very quickly to their they brought together this commission of absolutely everybody by the sounds of it.
Yes, and I think what's so interesting about that is that the quality of deliberation that you can have when you have these large groups of people broken into smaller groups allows them really to get to the nitty gritty. So in the case of Slovenia, for example, there was a kind of political stalemate because while the conventional metrics of a society, so, you know, people being, you know, healthier, more in contact with the wider world, people weren't happier. And it was very hard to understand from a political perspective why that was the case.
Mm.
And in the process of deliberating on this and trying to understand, well, what were the options for Slovenia? The people involved had to confront something they had never confronted before, which was deep societal distrust of one another. So those who in the Second World War had fought for the communists had done so because they were anti-fascist. And those who had fought with the Allies had done so because they were anti-communist. And they'd never really resolved what they were for. They'd only resolved what they were against, which were different, very radically different things. And actually being able to have that argument in miniature, in a way, allowed them to start looking at policies and procedures that could unite them both. And this had a really spectacular outcome in the sense that, you know, through essentially a nationwide conversation, the government came to accept recommendations, which they put a budget against, that came from these deliberative groups. And not only were they, you know, safe and sound recommendations, but of course, people implementing them could do so with a lot of enthusiasm and confidence because they knew they weren't just ideological, party political ideologies, that they really had come from the grassroots and that they had come in a response to something that previously no political party had been able or willing to tackle.
We all probably go into those rooms with an ideology.
Yes.
Whether you're very committed ideological, I mean, I describe myself as, say, for example, a socialist and a feminist, both of which would be considered an ideological position.
Yeah.
So how do you take the ideology out or do you work within different people's ideological frameworks?
Well, I think it's that what happens in these deliberative gatherings is that the sort of rigidities of ideologies tend to soften. It doesn't mean people change their values, but it does mean that they may change how they see the practical exercise of those values. So, for example, in the Citizens' Assembly over the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which is about abortion, I interviewed lots of people who took part in that. One of them said to me, you know, it was only through taking part in the Citizens' Assembly that he came to understand that actually, if you legalized abortion, it didn't mean that anybody had to have an abortion. It just meant that those who needed or wanted it were allowed to. And he said it made him think he didn't think that abortion was good. He didn't change his mind about that. But he understood that it wasn't his right to stop someone for whom this might be a life-saving experience. It wasn't his right to tell his daughters what would happen in a future that he might not even be around for. And so it isn't that he changed his view on abortion per se, but he changed his view in terms of what the government had a right to do to private decisions in people's lives.
Interesting. And the other one that I just wanted to touch on briefly, because I was slightly conflicted, was the one in Mexico.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, it was a fascinating idea that you were actually having people part of the drug cartels in the room, because if you didn't, yeah, you're not representing the whole world of the problem.
That's right.
But it, maybe I've misread, but it then felt like there was, even after that project was ongoing, there was still a very violent election that took place. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't an immediate solution coming from that.
No, and I think, so this was not so much a deliberative debate. This was a scenario planning exercise.
Right.
Trying to think about the where Mexico was and what possibilities stood before it. And I think, you know, what's been interesting about that is the degree to which the group involved, which, as you say, was wildly diverse, you know, from the chiefs of police to terrorists, from archbishops to, you know, women who'd suffered, you know, terribly at the hands of violent men, was to see that actually you can get that group of people to function.
Mm-hmm.
So however bedeviled with terrible societal problems Mexico is, it gave those people a sense that nevertheless it was possible to start thinking of a viable, healthier Mexico.
Right.
That didn't mean it made Mexico itself overnight, you know, squeaky clean and safe.
Sure.
But what it did do is it allowed all of those people to do work differently with different kinds of people than they had ever contemplated before. And after the election, it also meant that they represented, if you like, a kind of think tank for the government in terms of how might we address specific problems, in this case, particularly education.
Right.
So I think the real issue with that one is, you know, the question before it is how much of that experience might they be able to make more accessible to more of the population, mm-hmm, in order, mm-hmm, to change the way that the population can think about each other. And that's an ongoing story, you know, we'll see. Certainly the group that conducted that exercise was the same group that conducted a similar exercise after the ending of apartheid in South Africa. And I think, again, you can see that, you know, that had positive outcomes and less positive outcomes.
Sure. Yeah. And nothing is ever simple, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution, as is the theme of the book.
And it's not over.
Yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. So let's say that I wake up tomorrow and I find myself as Dominic Cummings, a bit. What one or two key pieces of advice would you give me in terms of how to approach, you know, the current situation we find ourselves in with the pandemic that we're currently fighting? And then what would you say to do for the longer term?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think the big issue with, well, I think there are two things. I think obviously, you know, the most immediate issue is getting the pandemic under control.
Yeah.
So reducing the rate of infection and being able to treat those who are already sick. I think the longer term issue is what do you do once you've achieved that to address the societal and economic consequences of that emergency. When you think of the number of people who will have lost their livelihoods, the number of companies that will have gone bust, the smaller number of jobs, therefore, that will be available, and the enormous amount of debt that dealing with the pandemic will have incurred, how do you set about creating an agenda for the government post-pandemic? And I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't think this is a part, I don't think a political party has the legitimacy to set that agenda. I think there will have been too much harm done by too many people for any one party to believe it genuinely represents the country. And I think this is exactly the condition in which you need to bring together groups for deliberative democratic debate to identify what the priorities are for the nation as a whole. I mean, you're going to have a whole generation of young people whose careers, social lives, sexual lives have just been stopped dead in their tracks. And they've been stopped in order to save the lives of their parents and grandparents. And they're going to enter a world with fewer jobs, with less money, and fewer opportunities. You know, that has to gain attention and priority. But, you know, I mean, I work with a lot of business leaders, and I'm very struck in the discussions I've been having with them over the last few weeks. Everybody is highly alert to what they're losing, and they want reparations, right? Big companies want reparations for the money they're losing. Small companies want reparations because they've been working for big companies that have exploited them during this crisis and extracted punitive terms from them. Everybody wants reparations for all the jobs that have been lost, for the capital that's been lost. And nobody thinks that they should be bottom of the list for repayment. So we have got to figure this out if we're going to maintain a society people can believe in. And I do not see any mechanism in British democracy as we see it today for doing that. So I think this is a perfect opportunity to do some democratic experiments to figure out actually what is it that people feel is just.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. I think you're right that there isn't enough consensus. We were not a united country before we went into this crisis. So there won't be enough consensus to get us out of it without actually that being something that we do jointly.
Yeah. And I think what I'm very struck by is, you know, after the banking crisis, you know, there was a lot of discussion of maybe everything will change now. And in the end, nothing changed. We went back to, you know, the pre-crisis normal and austerity. So what happened is the weak suffered and the rich got richer.
Yeah,
I can already hear, you know, in the public debate, the argument that's brewing between, you know, one group that says it'll be okay when the pandemic's over, we'll get back to business as usual, which, of course, as usual, you know, is lobbying. It's not prediction.
Yeah.
And another group saying, actually, this changes everything. And the one place we must not go back to is business as usual. We have to address the climate crisis. And we have to use this moment where everything is connected to really revision how the new world works. Now, this is a standoff. And everybody's piling in now, hoping to kind of win the argument before the argument even happens. You know? So this is a classic use of predicting the future in order to try to shape it. And my concern is I don't think either of those voices have the legitimacy they think they do.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I've obviously come down quite hard on the change everything side, but you'd expect that. But you're absolutely right that I can no more take advantage of this crisis than the Taxpayers Alliance can take advantage of this crisis, right. But we both have legitimate voices in shaping the future.
Exactly. And so we desperately, desperately need to use mechanisms to ensure that those voices are heard. Because if we come out of this with a sort of new plan that is felt to be illegitimate, that's going to be a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Margaret, thank you ever so much. It's been so illuminating and fascinating. It's been lovely talking to you. It's a really interesting book. And it's also really well written. I mean, I literally just sat down and read it and straight through.
Well, as you know, writing something that's easy to read is extremely hard work. So that's
I have spent most of my life translating wonk to human in various think tanks, so I couldn't agree more.
Right. Exactly.
So the book is called Uncharted, How to Map the Future Together by Margaret Heffernan. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm sure it's available in all good and less good bookshops. And just thank you ever so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it, especially given what a time we're all living in. I just to say that if you've enjoyed this episode, please do rate and review us on iTunes. We're always very grateful because it does help people come and find the podcast. And this has been a Political Human production. There's participatory budgeting, all of these. Sorry!
Oh my gosh, you okay?
I'm fine, my fucking cat just brought a bird in.
You see, that's unpredictable.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Oh, God. Shall I start again?
Yeah, I think probably.
Okay, so yes, I will deal with the bird, which, yes, thanks, Smudge.
Well, my cat obviously heard you because she's now left the room, obviously in search of something to kill.